I'm Gail Pastor, and I'm the director of the Folger Shakespeare Library.
I'm Georgiana Ziegler, and I'm head of reference at the Folger.
Wow. I am no scholar, but my understanding that this is, the Folger Shakespeare Library is actually where Shakespeare sat in the library, read his books,
Absolutely.
Wrote his plays and sonnets, and drank Folger's coffee. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
Hi, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 191, Folger Shakespeare Library. The Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C. is the largest collection of Shakespeare materials in the world, only a fraction of which is available to be seen by the general public. When we performed at the Kennedy Center last month, we were among the few, the happy few, who have been allowed access to the Folger's reading room and underground vault. Joining me on this very special behind-the-scenes tour of the Folger Library's coolest treasures were RSC performers Dominic Conti and Dee Ryan, as well as my brother John Titchener and brother-in-law Bob Moorhead, whose voices you'll also hear. As we made our way through the reading room and down to the vaults, Folger director Gail Pastor and reference librarian Georgiana Ziegler explained the protocols for such exclusive access.
When scholars come here, they come in, they dump their stuff in the locker, they come in here, they sign in. And then they go into the reading room where they have access to rare materials. So in order to actually leave the library, they go to the reference desk, they return any rare materials, they come and they give Eric, our watchdog, okay, our crack security officer, a pass, and it says, you're clear to go.
And Eric is the one who does the cavity searches.
He does, right.
Can you give us a background of when the whole place began, when it was founded?
Well, the two founders were Henry Folger and his wife Emily Folger, and they, in the course of their lives as a married couple without children, they collected Shakespeare editions and Shakespeare materials, Shakespeare-related materials, and they decided to, they were in New York, but they actually decided as a gift to the American people that they would build the library here. And so they did. And in 1932, the library was dedicated by President Herbert Hoover, uh-huh, in a great ceremony and on Shakespeare's birthday, so April 23rd, 1932. And we are now 78 years old.
Wow.
And in all this time, we have been and remain the world's largest Shakespeare collection.
Really?
So we are now in many things, including a library for advanced research by scholars, but mm-hmm, we're, as you know, a theater and a performing arts center and a advanced studies center and a place where kids perform.
And public museum.
All these things, yeah.
And what is your background? Are you a librarian or Shakespearean or both?
Well, I'm not a librarian. Georgiana is both.
Oh, okay.
She is a Shakespearean and a librarian, and I am just a plain Shakespeare scholar.
Okay.
Who runs this place?
Who runs the largest Shakespeare library in the world?
If you're a character in a Shakespeare play, what character are you?
Oh, dear.
Oh, the character that... I would be Rosalind. I would have to be Rosalind because mm-hmm, she's perfect.
Perfect, smart, verbose, lovely.
And cross-dresses, you know, she's...
I love your trousers, by the way.
Thank you. Exactly.
I know. I feel smarter already walking through there.
Here's the vault, and you can see this is really a vault.
It really is.
It looks like a bank vault.
It does.
It does.
You aren't kidding when you say vault.
No.
There's a reason why you don't call it the bowels. You call it the vault.
Right, the vault.
This is Shakespeare's Hummel collection. Am I correct?
Actually, it's a big collection of what I call theatrical tchotchke, which is really, it's great stuff. I love it. And some of it, a whole portion of it, are figurines and other materials relating to David Garrick, who was the great Shakespeare actor of the 18th century, who really kind of put Shakespeare on the map in English theater. And we have little figurines with Garrick. We have a little container for tea with a silver outside showing Garrick. We have snuff boxes. We have little medallions with Garrick. Garrick was really the first sort of actor self-promoter. And I've always said if there were T-shirts, there would have been a Garrick T-shirt, you know, except they didn't have T-shirts in the 18th century.
Or the word Garrick bobblehead.
You beat me to it.
This wonderful golden asp. It's a belt made in the form of a snake that was worn by the Polish-American actress Helena Modjeska. And it has emeralds in the head and a diamond, and it's all made out of articulated gold.
Wow.
So it's quite a splendid stage piece.
So it was worn in performance.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Can I have it?
Not right now.
Looks like it would fit, though.
Yeah.
So when we go into the vault, you'll hear the bell clang.
While we're doing theatrical tchotchka, I guess I could show you a couple of things in the art vault first.
Clang. Holy moly.
This is really great stuff. This is lots and lots and lots of statues and snuff boxes and tiles and all kinds of things of actors and actresses.
Busts.
So here in this drawer, we open up a case, and inside the case is a dagger. And the dagger belonged to Sir Henry Irving, who was the greatest late 19th century Shakespeare actor in England.
Wow.
And this is the dagger that he used for Hamlet.
That's so much more impressive than the rubber one I use. To play Hamlet.
This is actually a real dagger. I mean, if you take it out, it's got a point. You could get hurt with this. This is not something to just play with on the stage. So. And yet he did. That's right.
Wow. Can I have that?
But this is really macabre.
Okay.
If you like the macabre and strange.
Okay.
This is a bracelet made out of Edwin Booth's hair.
Oh my gosh.
The Victorians, for some strange reason, liked to make things out of hair. They had this sort of hair fetish. But this is actually rather attractive, and you wouldn't necessarily guess that it was made out of human hair.
Yeah.
Well, this was a bracelet. It looks like a man's bracelet to me, doesn't it to you? I mean, you know, and you just put it up your arm.
Right.
Yeah. The other weird thing about the Victorians is that they liked eyes. And they, beginning in the sort of late 18th century and into the 19th century, they did portraits of people's eyes. So here's a portrait of the eye of Charlotte Cushman.
Jeez, I thought you were going to show us Edwin Booth's eyes.
No. could have, but they, I suppose because they thought that the eye was the window to the soul. Mm. You can tell a lot about a person from their eye. Mm. And Charlotte Cushman was a well-known American actress who actually had quite a career in England as well. She was from Philadelphia. And what you see here are three portrait miniatures of her, and then just this little miniature of her eye set in a gold frame.
Wow.
It's very peculiar, but apparently people liked it.
And were these given to Charlotte? Were these things left by her, or would somebody carry that because they were a fan of hers?
I think something like that. I think these miniatures, she may have owned some of them, or you would give them to your friends.
You know, while I'm looking at all the tchotchkes and actors, what are the best performances of Shakespeare's plays or works that you've seen on stage or film? Do you have favorites?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I saw the David Tennant Hamlet recently, which I loved.
You saw that on PBS? Yeah.
No, I actually saw it in
a theater.
Stratford. Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
Right.
Even better.
And that was wonderful. It's interesting. It isn't clear that the greatest productions are the ones with stars in them, frankly, because I saw Richard II, you probably saw it too, Georgiana, Richard II in Stratford-upon-Avon with Sam West as Richard II, and it was benchmark. It was it was the best Richard II I will ever see.
Well, yeah.
I remember seeing Tony Scherr as Richard III, which was fabulous.
The spider.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was an amazing production. That's one of those productions you feel like, wow, you know, I'm glad I saw that because it'll be remembered.
Well, we
and
saw...
I saw Simon Russell Beale as Malvolio in Twelfth Night. Mm. He was unbelievable. He was wonderful.
Dee and I saw, on our honeymoon, at Stratford and the Swan, Nigel Terry play Pericles.
Wow.
In a great production, you would have thought Pericles was Shakespeare's greatest play based on this production.
We saw a production here that Mary Zimmerman directed of Pericles that was magic.
Mm.
Absolute magic.
Mm.
I mean, you know, a lot of it is what happens on the stage.
Yeah, yeah. And not necessarily with the stars.
And not necessarily with the stars, right. And not necessarily with the script.
Do you have opinions on the authorship question?
We have a fixed opinion.
You have a fixed opinion.
A fixed opinion of the truth.
Unwavering.
A fixed opinion of the truth.
A fixed opinion of the truth that William Shakespeare, or someone with his name, wrote the plays.
The man from Stratford.
The man from Stratford.
The Glover.
Indeed. The
yes.
Son of the Glover.
The son of the Glover, excuse me.
We should go across
All right.
the hall.
So where do you come down on the theory that Shakespeare was a time traveler from the future who erased all of his papers?
Whose theory is that?
Oh, that would be mine.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon of NPR News. You're listening to the Reduce Shakespeare Company podcast. Fool.
Where can you see the RSC? We post new tour dates on our website whenever we get the T's dotted and the I's crossed. But until then, the absolutely very best way to stay up to date about all of our performance dates is to sign up for our email newsletter. Go to our website, reducedshakespeare.com, and subscribe to The Reduced Reader. Just click on the link on the homepage.
This is really the heart of the heart of the library. What you are standing among is the third largest collection in the world of early English printed books and the largest collection by far of Shakespeare early quartos and folios.
Wow.
So, and they're straight ahead of you lying flat. So we have 79 Shakespeare first folios. Meisei University in Tokyo is the next largest holder with 11. So that's the gap.
Wow.
That's the gap.
Yeah, they're a distant second.
Yes.
I know you treat them pretty well here, but boy, they look great otherwise, like they were built to last.
This is linen rag paper. It's made out of old cloth.
Mm.
It doesn't have acid in it. It's incredibly durable, and if it's kept in proper conditions, it will be stable and will last forever, or at least as long
Close
as
enough.
A couple thousand years.
Yeah.
So here is a copy of the first folio that you can look at.
Oh my. And you're actually touching it with your human hands.
Yeah. We touch books here with our hands because you can actually feel the books. I mean, you can't feel what you're turning if you're wearing gloves. So our conservation people think that it's best to use your actual hands to touch the book, as long as they're clean.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you see the famous Droeshout portrait of Shakespeare, whose head looks as though it's floating on his ruff above his shoulders, but that's just the way it was done.
This is the engraving without the Groucho nose and mustache and glasses.
Right, yes. Yeah. Or without the clown nose or any number of other things that you see sometimes superimposed on the Droeshout.
With the terrible haircut.
Definitely. There's the poem in here by Ben Jonson, which calls Shakespeare soul of an age and swan of Avon and all those things that we are used to hearing Shakespeare called. My favorite part, though, is the letter in the front by John Heming and Henry Condell, who were the two actors who got this project going. And they say, to the great variety of readers, well, it's now public, and you will stand for your privilege, we know, to read and censure. Do so, but buy it first.
But buy it first.
And they say again, whatever you do, buy.
Don't just stand here in the book stall.
Put your money where your mouth is. If you're going to make criticisms of it, buy the book first.
Can I touch?
Sure.
Oh, my gosh. So when, what year was this? These pages?
This was printed in 1623. Shakespeare died in 1616. And so his manuscripts of his plays belong to his company, his acting company, which would be sort of like today, people who write scripts for television shows. I mean, they don't own their own scripts, really, and they don't kind of publish them. But so the scripts that Shakespeare wrote were the property of the acting company, and so these guys got all of this together, and they had it published. They got the idea from Ben Jonson, who knew Shakespeare, and of course was the other really major dramatist of Shakespeare's time, who published his own plays in a large, important-looking first folio in 1616. Mm. And that was the first time that plays had ever been printed and put out in a large folio volume. Because folios generally are histories, they're law books, they're Bibles, but they're not usually this kind of literature.
Nothing so trivial
nothing
as a play.
Nothing so trivial as a play, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have the original play scripts? Do you have the original?
There are no original scripts of Shakespeare's plays. We wish there were, but there aren't. The only one that may have Shakespeare's handwriting in it is something called A Play of Sir Thomas More, which he collaborated on with other people. Mm. And there's some feeling that a page or so of that manuscript may be in his hand, but we don't really have any existing.
I remember when I saw the movie Shakespeare in Love, and he tosses away first draft into a burning fire, and I literally gasped. I went, no.
That probably really wasn't what he was doing. For one thing, they didn't waste paper. So, if he had written on one side and didn't like it, he more likely would have turned it over and written on the other side instead of just crumpling it up and throwing it on the floor or something.
Right.
Paper was way too expensive to waste like that.
Right.
So you would never, that movie was full of anachronism.
What? It was a documentary. What?
But some of them, they did on purpose, and then some of them were by accident. That was an accidental anachronism.
I'm a high school English teacher, so I'm curious as to, what is perhaps the biggest misnomer or the biggest falsehood that you think is passed on to high school students about Shakespeare? Is there something? For example, I've always said or always told students that the folio was put together generally from people's memory, from actors. If they didn't have scripts,
they did have scripts.
They just don't exist anymore.
Right.
So they did have a script they worked with, and so the folio is just a reproduction of those scripts. It wasn't taken from various.
Well, the quartos, this is a huge and pretty contested turf, but the quartos, some of the quartos may have been constructed memorially by actors, but probably not. We think more likely that the companies who owned the scripts were actually releasing them in a very calculated way to the printers, partly to sort of keep the plays fresh in people's memories. Just because you own a copy of something doesn't mean you don't want to go see it, right? On the stage.
Sure.
And certainly the plays in the folio, particularly the folio only plays, were printed from the Playhouse copy.
Everybody points to the 2 hours traffic of our stage at the end of the prologue of Romeo and Juliet to say that Shakespeare never did the entire play.
Listen, this is another huge controversy.
Thanks for bringing it up, Bob.
Well, okay, so you don't have watches. What you have are bells, right? Bells that toll the hour. So when they say 2 hours traffic of the stage, do they mean that two bells tolled? Is it something less than 4 hours? Right? Less than 3 hours? Right. So the whole question of did they talk faster? Probably they did. Was their acting style more fluid and fast because they didn't have, after all, scenery? Probably it was.
Nor did they have bathrooms for the audience.
And they understood Shakespeare's English.
Right.
We have that problem today with audiences who don't understand Shakespeare's English, but that was their English.
Right, but we slow it down, yeah. Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so the question of could they do a play, let's say a play shorter than Hamlet, in 2 hours? Probably close, yeah, for sure. So again, do we know the answer? No, we don't.
Well, and another thing that I understand, and I don't know whether it's true, is that the English accent of the day was closer to an American accent now. Is that true?
That's what they say.
Yeah?
Yeah, well, we'll have to dig up some old Elizabethans and ask them. Right.
Do you want to see some quartos?
Yes, please.
Yes. And these are the ones that were published during Shakespeare's lifetime.
Okay.
Here's a good example of what they would do to advertise a play. Here we have The History of Henry IV. published in 1599. So after you saw the play, you could go to a bookstall in and around St. Paul's Church in London, and you could buy this book. And this is the front cover of the book, as it would have been on display in the shop. So it says, "With the battle at Shrewsbury between the king and Lord Henry Percy, surnamed Henry Hotspur of the North, with the humorous conceits of Sir John Falstaff." Mm-hmm. Now, what are they doing? They're picking out the most popular parts in the play. People right. liked Harry Hotspur, and they also liked Sir John Falstaff. So those are the two characters who are given top billing on the title page.
Well, and then it also says newly corrected by
W. Shakespeare. Yeah, and the early quartos often don't have Shakespeare's name even on the title page, but eventually they do put his name on. And then sometimes, in order to indicate that maybe this is even a better one than the one that you saw a couple weeks ago in the shop or last year in the shop, they'll say newly corrected by right. W. Shakespeare. This is, what I have here is the one and only in the world copy of the quarto of the most lamentable Roman tragedy of Titus Andronicus.
Wow.
As it was played by the Right Honorable the Earl of Derby, Earl of Pembroke, and Earl of Sussex, their servants. That's the very, very early acting company that Shakespeare belonged to. Even before the Lord Chamberlain, even before the Kingsmen, it was this company of the Earl of Derby in Pembroke.
Do you guys hold out hope to discover other lost scripts like Cardenio or Love's Labor's Found, or is that a thing we hope for, or is that not likely to happen?
Well, you know, amazing things happen,
yeah.
right? I mean, so yeah, I would say that there are many, many private libraries still where people don't know what they've got,
really?
Frankly. Yeah.
I mean, so it's not even lost in an attic somewhere. It might be on a shelf and people just don't even...
It's not lost in an attic. It's yeah. it's maybe on somebody's shelf and they some great house library and they don't know it yet. I mean, do I think it's likely? No.
Okay.
But is it possible? Of course. You know.
Where's that note that says, in Shakespeare's hand, yeah, I wrote the plays. Get over yourselves.
And what would that prove? I mean, this is what I find so interesting is like, okay, so you find a manuscript and you compare it to the known signatures of Shakespeare and you say, well, maybe this could be it. Well, right. you know, what does it prove?
Well, and what do you study here? Are you studying the man or are you studying the works?
We're studying both. I mean, I think we've had people certainly, I mean, Sam Schoenbaum, who is the greatest of the modern biographers of Shakespeare, did a lot of his work here. He did a lot of his work in London, but he did a lot of his work here. But mostly we're studying his works, and I would say we're studying his time.
And you remember that the date of the first folio is 1623, and this copy is a little tatty. It's been preserved. Mm-hmm. It's been mended. But you'll notice on these pages that they're children's drawings. There are little stick figures in the front. There's a little living room. There's a little house, and there are two outhouses next to it. And
they could have been drawn. He wouldn't be that tall.
They could have been drawn yesterday, and they in fact were drawn just about 100 years after the folio was printed, and they were drawn in 1729
wow.
because there are two signatures here. From a girl named Elizabeth Ockle, and she writes Elizabeth Ockle, her book, 1729. And on the opposite page, she writes E. Ockle, her book, 1729. So I think that these were her younger brothers or sisters who were doing these drawings in here. They probably just found the book in their family library and took it off the shelf, and it had a lot of blank space in the front, so they just doodled in it, you know. But you're right, I mean, it looks like some kid did it yesterday. There's something kind of basic about children's drawing, you know?
Yeah.
It doesn't change. it's really neat.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. You can see pictures of everything we saw on our tour at the Folger Shakespeare Library website, folger.edu. We'll also put a link to their slideshow on the listing for this podcast episode 191 at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Send us your rediscovered Shakespeare manuscript via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company fan page at facebook.com. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel email or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reduceshakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, Shakespearean scholar Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Rob Gonzo. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Scott Simon from National Public Radio and to Gail Pastor and Georgiana Ziegler for that fantastic tour. And special thanks to Garland Scott, the head of external relations and the chief twit of the Folger Shakespeare Library, for putting this all together. You can follow the Folger Shakespeare Library on Twitter at Folger Library, all one word. Finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 191/573 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
If you were going to write a movie, a Da Vinci Code movie, what would your plot be?
Well, I don't know what Gail thinks. I mean, my holy grail would be to find an actual manuscript of a Shakespeare play.
In his hand.
And there are. I mean, it's not impossible because there are some from his contemporary in Spain, Lope de Vega. There are various Lope de Vega manuscripts. I've even seen some of them. They're little booklets, just like little notebooks, and you wrote the play in it, and, you know, that's how it was done. And I think that's the way Shakespeare did his. We just haven't found any.
Right.
It would be so cool.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reduceshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.